Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Aaron Newcomb and Dan Lynch, episode 186, recorded on October 12th, 2011. Superfeeder. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your Mac, PC, iPad, iPhone, Android device, or TV instantly, all streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Welcome to another edition of Floss Weekly. I'm Aaron Newcomb, and I'm joined today by Dan Lynch over in the UK. Dan, how's it going?
Great, thanks. Yeah, I'm in not-so-sunny Liverpool in the north of the UK, although you can't tell because I've blocked up the window because it looks so ugly and grey out there that I decided to block it up. But it's always good to be back.
Yeah, I was wondering what that was. I thought maybe some sort of early holiday decoration or something like that.
It's actually soundproofing. You're not going to hear it, obviously, but I've blocked up the window with some foam to soundproof it, only temporarily. So maybe I'll put it online. I'll put it on my blog so I can remove it. But there we go. It's open source soundproofing.
Awesome. Great. Well, today we're going to be talking about Superfeeder, which should be really interesting. So we're going to bring on our guest in just a minute. But Superfeeder is kind of a RSS feed middleman, so to speak. So it's not necessarily an aggregator, but it seems to be some sort of a way to parse feeds and send those out. So there seems like I know on their webpage they have interesting links into if you're a subscriber, here's what we do for you. If you're a publisher, here's what we do for you. So, and it's gotten a lot of attention too. I don't use it, but I've heard a lot about it. So it should be kind of an interesting topic, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people using it as well. A quick look at the quick look at their client list is quite impressive. So I can't wait to talk to them about it and find out more.
Right. And Randall is not here, obviously. You figured that out by now, if you're watching. But Randall will actually be back next week, I believe. He's been off gallivanting around the world on various cruises and touring around Italy and all these places. So he's been off for a break, but he will be back to do a series of episodes again. So if you're missing Randall, if you're a big Randall fan or a Kermit the Frog impressionist fan, he will be back next week to start picking up on some episodes, and we'll tell you about those at the end of the show. Also, I do want to say real quickly before we get too far in here that it was nice to see a few folks at Oracle World and also at Android Open. For those of you that came up and said hi, really appreciate that. There was a few of you that came up and said, hey, I like your work. You're doing great. I want to see more of you on Twit and so forth. So anyway, I really appreciate that. Thanks for coming up. And always, if I'm at an event, please don't be shy. Feel free to come up and say hi and all of that. Android Open was a very interesting conference, by the way, I should say. If you're into Android and you want to learn more about it, I would say definitely this was their first year this year, but definitely keep track of that conference and next year plan to attend because it was very, very interesting. It's an O'Reilly conference, so pretty standard format, but very, very interesting content there. All right, so before we bring in our guests, we do have an ad this week, and we're going to be talking about Netflix. Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you instantly, which saves you time, money, and hassle, most of all the hassle, which is great. There's several ways to kind of consume Netflix. So you can watch Netflix on your TV or your PC or Mac. You can also watch on your iPhone or Android phone. In fact, a few months ago, they released support on more of the older Android phones. So if you weren't able to get it before, you should definitely go check it out. If you have a gaming console like an Xbox 360 or a PS3 or a Wii, you can watch that way. That's one of the ways that I watch Netflix. And if you're not a gamer, you can actually watch Netflix on your TV with an Apple TV box or a Roku box, which are very, very popular and very inexpensive to use, as they just released actually a cheaper Roku box recently. So you want to go pick that up. And with Netflix, you can watch movies and TVs instantly using any of those devices or methods. And you can begin watching a movie or show on one device and then finish on another device, which is very handy since we're all very busy running around and traveling and so forth. Whichever way you want to choose to access Netflix, you can watch as many TV shows and movies as you want anytime. And you can cancel anytime. So it's month to month. If you don't want to continue, you can just cancel at the end of the month. If you want to try Netflix today for 30 days free, go to netflix.com/twit and be sure to use that URL, netflix.com/twit. That way you'll know that you heard about it on Twit, and we'll get some credit for that and hopefully be able to bring you more great content. So we thank Netflix for their support of Twit, and we hope that you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix. All right. So with that, let's bring on our guests. Julian, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Awesome. Julian Genestu, am I saying that correct?
Yes, that's good.
All right, great. Where are you? Where are we talking to you from today?
I am currently in France, even though Superfido is based out of San Francisco, but I travel a lot because I am French originally, and my whole family, friends, and close family are here in France, in Lyon, exactly.
Okay, great. Well, you look good. You must have a good internet connection there because you're coming in loud and clear.
Yeah, I actually do have fiber, I think, in my building, so it's great.
jealous. I wish. All right. Well, we're talking about Superfeeder today, and describe your role. Are you the founder, creator, lead developer?
I am both the founder and the creator of Superfeeder. I am also the CTO. I mean, I get pretty much all the roles there, and work mostly with contractors. So yeah, I'm the Superfeeder guy.
Great. So how long has Superfeeder been around? It wasn't always Superfeeder, was it? It had previous names, correct?
Not really. I mean, Superfeeder is actually not the name of the company. It's the name of our main product right now. And the company is called Notifectious, but it's not really interesting, I think.
That's what was fooling me. Okay.
Uh-huh. And we've been around a bit more than 2 years now, working on making the web real time.
Okay, good. Well, we kind of did a brief description in the intro. We probably messed it up completely, but we kind of tried to describe it. But it's basically a service that allows people to parse RSS or Atom feeds into what they want to view, right?
Exactly. I mean, the idea came from a pretty simple. Fact that pretty much every service out there that consumes RSS feeds, and there's actually a lot of services that consume RSS feed, pull the same feeds over and over again. And we thought it was actually a waste of resources for all these subscribers, but also for the service being pulled. And we just assumed that, hey, if there could be one guy in the middle who actually does that polling and finds better way to get the content and then pushes the content to all the subscribers, all the people who are interested in this, we would save a lot of resources and at the same time pretty do a better job for the publisher, because the publisher would have a single person to talk to, and then a better job for the subscribers because they would get like timely results on the data.
Right. So let me break this down a little bit. So for example, I use a reader. It's not Google Reader. It's NetVibes. But let's say Google Reader, NetVibes, whatever, a front page that has, where you're pulling in RSS feeds. That's one example of where you might pull in an RSS feed. So I've got it set up to point to the RSS feeds that I'm interested in. So like Engadget, Reddit, a bunch of other Elixir News, a bunch of other services. And they all have to go out periodically and refresh those RSS feeds to make sure they're current.
Exactly.
And what I could do is I could just point that to Superfeeder and let you guys handle that, right?
No? Not really. So we're actually an infrastructure service. So we're not a service that you as an end user could use directly. We're a service that people like NetVibes, like Google Reader, like maybe iTunes as well, like thousands of other services can use to get the content so that they don't have to poll and they can just offload the polling to us. So it's perfectly transparent to the end user. We actually work on sometime for the subscribers, the way I described it, and sometimes for the publisher. So if you're, say, Tumblr, you're a massive blog network, the biggest out there right now, and you've got like thousands of services polling your feeds all the time, and this is wasting a lot of your resources. So what you want to do is actually call Superfeeder, which is us, and say, hey, I'm going to tell you when my feeds are updated. Please tell all these guys after that. So they save a lot of resources because they do not get polled as often, and at the same time, the services who wanted the data get it as soon as it's available. Does that make sense?
Right. So how does that work in reality then? In my example, let's say when I go out and I subscribe to the Engadget feed, How does that work? So it's pulling from you instead of pulling from them. How does it work in you know, what? Obviously, I'm not typing in anything differently with the RSS feed, right? So how are you coming into the mix there?
Sure. So in the feed itself, there might be an element called discovery. So I'm not sure about the Engadget feed. It used to be there. I'm not sure it's still there, but it's one of our customers as well. It used to be. Huffington Post is one of them. And we have TechCrunch, ReadWriteWeb. So what they do is in the feed itself, they have a tag, an XML tag that points to the hub and say, hey, look, there's a hub there. And this hub is Superfeeder. And you can get the data in real time from there. So the end user doesn't even see it. But the application that is able to parse the XML can see this. Once they have identified the hub, they go to the hub, which is us, and say, hey, hub, looks like you have this content in real time. Please send it to me because I need it. Right?
Right.
Next time, since the publisher actually advertises the hub in its content, they will ping us. They will tell us, hey, Superfeeder, I have updated this content. What we will do then is actually fetch the feed, diff it, see what's actually new versus what's not new in there, and send only the new stuff to the subscribers. So only the new stuff to the ReadWriteWeb, to the Google Reader, to the NetVibes, to all the people consuming this information.
Right. So to the end user, to the subscriber, it's transparent. And to the publisher, all they really have to do is set it up so that they're making sure that they give you the information on a regular basis so that the feeds can be updated. But basically, for the end user, it's completely transparent.
Exactly. And this is just in theory again, because we can actually poll feeds, as I described earlier in the beginning, on a time basis. So we say, hey, we go fetch every feed every 15 minutes or so. But we can also do stuff like monitor sources online that would tell us when a feed has been updated. So it's very often that feeds are related. I usually take this example where you have a newspaper and they have a feed per each journalist, each author. And then they also have a feed for each category of the newspaper, right? So they have a sports feed and then a finance feed. What we will fetch is we fetch the finance feed, and then we see that there's a new article written by John Smith, who is a reporter there. Since we've seen a new entry in the sports feed from John Smith, we can safely fetch the John Smith feed because we know it's going to be there as well, right?
Right.
So we've built this thing that we call the feed graph that relates feed together based on past updates, but based also on links that we can find online, assuming that if one of them is updated, another one is going to be updated as well.
Right. So you're actually analyzing the data as well.
Yes.
To comparing, you know, like you say, multiple feeds have the same link to the same article or whatever. You're able to analyze that in real time and actually provide a better service both for publishers and subscribers that way.
Definitely, exactly. Now, so we don't need to be very – sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to – go ahead and finish your thought, and then I'll ask another question.
So we don't need to hammer publishers all the time to know if there is anything new that they've been publishing.
Right.
We also use a lot of different techniques. The people who've been watching this field online for a couple of years would probably know about services like Ping-O-Matic. It's a service that basically allows anyone to ping and say, hey, my content is new. And it's pretty much built in any blog out there, in a WordPress blog, for example, or any standalone blogging platforms. And so we monitor these services as well to know if something has been updated. Obviously, the problem there is that there's a lot of spam, so we need to clean up the data, but it's also a very good signal for us to know that something has been updated and that we can safely go fetch it.
Right. Now, do you offer analytics back to the subscribers as a service or to the publishers as a service as well?
Yes, we do. So when the publisher designates us as their main hub, as the place where they can, where subscribers can get their data, we tell them about who are these subscribers. We tell them how many people, are subscribed to any given feed. We tell them a lot of different things on the subscription side. We're working on providing them more data on the publication side. So telling them, hey, we pushed your story to 15 different services and here they are. Here is the list of the services. What you have to remember is like, since we're only talking to services, we might not know who are the end user subscribers.
Right.
So let me take the Google Reader example. Google is our biggest subscriber. We push millions of updates per day to Google from many, many different sources. The thing is Google subscribe on behalf of many of their services and products. So obviously on behalf of Google Reader, but also on behalf of FeedBurner because they cache the feeds, but also on behalf of Google News and even also on behalf of the search index. But they subscribe only once for all of these services. And even if like 50 different people subscribe to a given feed into Google Reader, they will subscribe only once. So we do not have a lot of data to show to the publisher about the Google subscriber. We can just tell them, hey, we send it to Google, but we don't know what's happening there afterwards.
Right, because they're basically a middleman as well.
Exactly.
Yeah. But there could be a lot of, I guess the real value here, and I'm looking at this from a marketing perspective, since I kind of do that in my day job, but there is a real value here in terms of, if you're doing this yourself, like I do with my, maybe I'll start using Superfeeder. I basically do it myself, right now. And I publish my feeds because I have feeds for content and feeds for the main page and so forth. I can go back in my web logs and look and see who's accessing those. I can use Google Analytics to see where they're accessing those files from. But I have no idea what other related content might be coming in. So all I can see is some very basic information. But you're actually able to provide a really valuable service here in that you can show related information, I'm guessing, about who else is accessing similar types of data and things like that, correct?
So we're actually working on this, improving the feedback to the publishers in terms of what's happening with the data, what the publisher do, and how often it is used and stuff like this. Most of the time, unfortunately, the best way to track really the usage of a feed is to add content in there that you can later observe. So one of the ways that is mostly used is to just put like images in the feed and then see how many times they've been loaded by a given feed reader so that you can track how many people actually saw the image in the feed and assume that the number of times that an image has been seen is the number of time that is the amount of people who actually subscribe to your content.
Right.
What we can do though, and that is very, very interesting at our level, is since we get all these subscribers, so we have about 5 million feeds in the system right now that go through Superfeeder at any given point, we are able to build this massive funnel, and we get at any given time, we know what data is new, and we can do stuff on there like filtering based on, say, keywords. So we have this amazing feature called Track that you can just use and say, hey, give me any mention of a name, obviously a username, a brand name, or any combination of words that are happening in real time at Superfeeder. So actually use this to monitor stuff like keyword like PopSop Hubbub, which is the protocol that I'm describing here, or Superfeeder, which is obviously Superfeeder's name. And we track this, and then in real time, I get any mention that people have somewhere on the web done about either PopSop Hubbub or Superfeeder, and I can go there and comment and help people out. So this is very interesting where instead of having a geographical approach to the web where you go to one website to another and you browse like Google does with the bots, you can have a time-based approach where you see the web as it's deploying, if you want, rather than seeing the web as it is laid out.
Right.
Does it make sense?
Yeah. Well, it does to me anyway. I think it's a really interesting service. I mean, is the subscription part how you monetize it? I mean, we should say that you this is a company that actually has before we get in, we're going to get into the open source stuff. Don't worry, we're just kind of laying the tracks here so everybody has an understanding of what's going on. But I mean, you guys are actually making money, correct? And you've got funding from Mark Cuban, I believe.
Yes, Mark Cuban and BetterWorks out of New York.
Right. So, I mean, is that the monetization plan? Subscription fees? How does that work?
So yeah, so we actually charge. I usually tend to give this description to people like we're like the transporters out there. I studied some kind of marketing and finance, and maybe you guys are not familiar with Incoterms, but these are the terms that two companies working together use to buy and sell goods from one to another. And these define, for example, who is in charge of the transportation. So sometimes it's the seller who is in charge of the transportation, and sometimes it's the buyer. And we are exactly like a transporter in this case, so we're pretty much like the UPS or the FedEx here. Sometimes we work for the publisher who publishes their data, so we transport their data to the subscribers, and sometimes we work for a given subscriber. And the way we charge is pretty much simple, is volume-based. So the more data we transport from publisher to a subscriber, we charge the person who is the one giving us the order of transporting that data.
Right. So that's brilliant because obviously there's going to be sites out there like Engadget. We keep using them as an example, so let's stick with it. So like Engadget that updates their feeds, every 5 minutes or so, probably.
Yeah.
They push a lot of information out there. So basically, they pay the a higher rate, so to speak, because they're pushing more data. Whereas somebody like me, who actually only updates their feeds once every 6 months, apparently, at this point, I just have no time whatsoever.
So in practice, even Engadget is a very small platform for us. We work with Tumblr, as I said before, and we provide the hub for all the Tumblr blogs. So all the Tumblr blogs combined do way more and like thousands times more updates than Engadget. We get about 500 pings a second from Tumblr right now. So it's like 500 updates a second on Tumblr. And we work for platforms like Etsy as well, which is an e-commerce platform. So it's not something that end users are usually used to, but feeds can also be used by machines to learn information about other services. And in the context of Etsy, we push all the updates to their product lists, to the prices, and any data update basically that happens on Etsy, which is becoming one of the major e-commerce platforms out there. So all this data goes through Superfeeder, and even if Engadget is, I agree with you, like for an end user, it's a lot of data. To us, to Superfeeder, it's actually very minor.
So you're talking about this massive load that you've got. I mean, 500 pings a second from Tumblr. How do you deal with that kind of that load on your servers and stuff? How is this scaled up?
So it's very simple. We built Superfeeder in a very, very distributed way. We have about 80 servers at Linode right now, and this is all distributed. So when we get a ping, we put that in a queue system, and we have workers that get there, get the data, and then send the data to other types of worker that actually list the subscribers and then send the data to whoever needs it. This is very, very distributed, and it's the only way we can deal with such a load.
Okay, right. That makes sense. And you were talking about all of the many big services that are using Superfeeder. Now, I was doing some research on this today, and probably the biggest service that people would know that at the moment is not using Superfeeder is Twitter, and I have a kind of a controversial question, I suppose. Does that present you any kind of problems? Because they're very very much not keen to let other people publish their content. So have you talked to them about that, or is there anything you're keen to maybe make happen in the future?
Sure, I tried to talk with them many times. It's not technical reason that prevent Twitter from using either Superfeeder or even build their own platform using the same protocol. I would say it's more business reasons. It's the fact that they want to be in full control of the data and that they do not allow anyone to get access to the data to redisplay it. They want to have full control on who does what with the data. And the PubSub/PubHub protocol that we promote is actually a distributed protocol in a way that it's very... It gives power to subscribers and publishers without having a formal relationship between the two. And Twitter wants to have a formal relationship with anyone who accesses the data.
That makes sense.
Business relationship.
Yeah, I got what you meant there. So we need to talk about the whole open source stuff, because this is Floss Weekly, and this is a hosted service, right? So I wouldn't be hosting this myself. If I was a publisher and I needed to publish this content, you would host the service, and I would come to you to do it. So how does that work with licensing and so on? Is the stuff open source, and what license is it under?
It's an open protocol first. So it's a protocol that anyone can implement, and we actually advise people to implement it. There's a lot of platforms that do not want to use Superfeeder for a reason or another, and we think it's actually good that they implement the protocol even without Superfeeder. Examples include Flickr, who uses PubSub/PubHub on their own, and they haven't used Superfeeder. Another example is WordPress, that you may be familiar with. All the WordPress blog, WordPress.com blog, are PubSub/PubHub enabled without using Superfeeders. Another example is obviously Blogger, Google hosts one big hub out there. I should say that the PubSub/PubHub protocol was actually created by two Google engineers, and Google implemented the first public hub at the time. So there's the idea is like, hey, anybody can do this. Not everybody will do it. It's pretty much the same assumption with a lot of online services. Anybody can host their website and put their profile online and blah, blah, blah. But not everybody does it for a reason or another. I mean, New York Times doesn't want to be just on Facebook. They want to have their own website. And it's the same. Not everybody wants to create the software to push their content, even though anybody or everybody should actually push their content.
Okay, so have you documented your pub-sub-hub, let me see if I can say that right, pub-sub-hub-hub implementation if other people wanted to get an idea of how you've kind of made it more efficient? Do you provide documentation or anything like that?
Yeah, we obviously do provide documentation on the website. We try to stick with the protocol itself for a lot of reasons. I mean, working on the web and because we deal with a lot of HTTP is a place where we can see that even open standard protocol are not the key to perfect compatibility between services. We've seen a lot of horrendous things with HTTP or with XML, as a matter of fact, and Atom or RSS. But we try to force ourselves to stick with the spec and say, hey, even if we want to go forward, even if we think that this is not the perfect thing, I mean, this specific point is not working well, we'd rather have something that is imperfect, but everybody understands and everybody agrees with, than something that is perfect, but that we're the only one to use.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that makes total sense. And why did you choose to use that protocol instead of maybe other popular protocols like XMPP and so on for pushing this content and pinging and so on?
So when we started Superfeeder, we actually first implemented an XMPP API, and we're very, very big fans of XMPP. We actually use it internally. I described earlier our architecture, and this is only XMPP workers. So it's chat clients that are a little bit smarter than just, not smarter, but like not just chat, that connect and ask for work to one another and distribute the word this way, right? So when we initially started, we started with XMPP. And then two things happened at the same time. On one hand, as I described earlier, the two Google engineers, Brad Slatkin and Brad Fitzpatrick, that you might know from Memcache and from a lot of other open source projects, came up with PubSubHubHub. And we found out that, hey, this was a very good solution in terms of not theoretically speaking. It's definitely not the best solution if you look at, like, hey, how can we do it the more efficient way possible? But it's a very good solution in terms of pragmatism, in terms of, hey, how can we get web developers around there that are used to create stuff on a Linode or on a Slice host in very using PHP to use PubSubHubHub and to adopt PubSubHubHub. And we found out that using HTTP and using RSS feeds was something that was very obvious in this context. At the same time, XMPP, we found that a lot of people were very scared about this protocol, that we love XMPP again, but we know that there's a lot of issues, a lot of complexities that are involved with it. And a lot of people are very scared by the complexity and may not look at the solution just because it's XMPP. So we still provide both APIs. We have a vast majority of people using PubSubHubHub, but we do have XMPP subcases because PubSubHubHub doesn't work for all the cases out there.
So speaking of technical complexity, I mean, without giving away your secret sauce, what's your infrastructure like to be able to support all this? I mean, you benefit a little bit from the data type that we're talking about, obviously, because I'm guessing we're mostly talking about text with links and things, and not video files or images or documents, which are bigger file types. But talk about your infrastructure a little bit, because I'm kind of curious how you're able to support this. Obviously, we were looking at the page earlier. We had it up. And it says you got the little ticker there that says how many entries you're dealing with, and it's up into the 10 billions. And I don't know I don't know how that's tracked. I don't know if it's all time or a week or a month, or I don't know how many entries.
Oh, it's all time. It's all time.
Okay, so far you've dealt with or handled over 10 billion entries. I mean, that's a lot of data.
It might actually be a bit more now, but so this counter is JavaScript on the page because it's very hard for us to track the exact number since it's all distributed. We do not have a single place where we can say, hey, this is a new one, this is a new one, this is a new one. But anyway, that's not part of the discussion. It's roughly the speed at which we push content right now. A bit less than what we do now, but it used to be more. So let's say it's a good number. In terms of our architecture, we are very, very open and very transparent on how we do it. Our approach is to be the platform that anybody can use. I mean, I wouldn't use a bike if I didn't know how it worked, because I would be very, very scared of what could happen, right? And it's pretty much the same with everything on my computers or anything else. I don't want to use solution that I have no idea how they work. So we're very transparent on how Superfeeder works, because we hope that people can trust us and say, fine, if I know how this works, if I can even participate and help fix things, then I'm going to be in confidence and then eventually use the service. So there's no secret source, nothing here that is a secret. We use A lot of different things. As I said earlier, we're using XMPP as the main bus, if you want, between all our components in the application. So we have different types of components. We have what we call parsers. Parsers are in charge of fetching a feed and then parsing it and then diffing it. And then we have what we call firehosers, the second family, which are in charge of pushing the content forward to all the subscribers. Obviously, they send the data between the two using XMPP. And then we have what we call rings that are actually Redis servers that are a little bit tweaked on which we rotate the feeds. So the way it works is, since we need to fetch every feed at any given point, we need to have a data structure that we can parse or browse very, very quickly so that we can grab a feed, fetch it, diff it, and push forward very quickly. Right, so these rings are actually real rings because we take an element in the front and we put it in the back very quickly. And then they have different sizes. Obviously, they all rotate at the same speed on the circle. But if they have less elements, obviously the elements in each of the feeds, in each of the rings, are going to be parsed more often. That makes sense?
Yep.
So coming back to the bike analogy, if we have a lot of feeds on a ring, each of the feeds is going to be fetched less often. And if we have very few feeds, then each of the feeds is going to be fetched very often. So we sort all the feeds on these rings. We have about 10. We have actually exactly 10 now. One of them being very small, and so that each feed can be fetched every 10 seconds. And then the big one is huge, and it's for feeds that are fetched very, very less often, like twice a day at most. And then we have also what we call a feed cache, which is where we store all the feed graph that I described earlier. So all the graph on which we can propagate updates. So we know that this feed has been updated. This one, which is linked to the first one, can be updated, so we fetch it. Is that clear enough?
Clear as mud.
All right.
It actually is. I was joking. The point I was getting at, and what I think what you just described is true, is that this gets very complex very quickly. Because, you know, when you're dealing with more than one feed and you're dealing with all these options, different options for different sources, as well as, you know, analyzing that data as well, you've got to be very careful about your resource utilization, I'm assuming.
Yeah, definitely. We use Chef, that you guys are mostly familiar with, I guess, which is a deployment solution to be able to deploy and scale very quickly in terms of adding more servers to fetch more feeds or removing servers if we don't need them anymore. We use a lot of techniques to be very elastic. So this is a very Amazon-y word, but we need to be very elastic in terms of grow and decrease very easily and very often. So we use a lot of these. At the same time, I tend to tell people, hey, if you want to fetch 10 feeds, it's probably easier to build a cron job and then go off each of your feeds. When you start having thousands, tens of thousands, millions of them, it becomes really complex to go fetch each of them in a timely manner and be resilient to failures.
Right.
And there's a bunch. So you probably remember when Tumblr had a lot of growth issues in the past year. And it was a nightmare for us because we were pretty much the people pulling them the most often. And we would get timeouts. So rather than have a feed in a couple milliseconds, it would take like 5 seconds to time out, which makes the whole thing slower for us because we're fetching a feed and then it's 5 seconds rather than a couple of milliseconds. So all the feeds after this one are late. And since a lot of them are still Tumblr, they're late again, they're late again, they're late again. So we have a lot of things that we need to deal with that make the system very powerful at big scale, but also very, very complex.
Yeah. And this is the thing too, that, you know, kind of some of the things I've been thinking about as you're describing this, for large organizations that depend on these feeds, obviously their main concern is, I'm assigning my part of my livelihood, so to speak, over to a third party, in this case, Superfeeder. So you're worried about that. And likewise, in from your perspective, obviously, if Superfeeder goes down, in some big way, obviously all of these sites are going to be without a service for a certain amount of time.
Definitely. We try to do a good job, and being distributed is a good, easy way to be resilient to failures. Since it's feeds, at worst we're late in terms of we tell you something is new, even though it's been new for like an hour, 2 hours, 5 hours, maybe. That's the worst thing that can happen. Because you don't need, I mean, since we actually push the data, people don't need to link, to hot link the data through us. So if you're, if we push you the data and then we're down, nobody cares, right? So the worst thing that can happen is like you get the data late, which sometimes is really bad. We actually had use cases where people would not get the data in a timely manner, and they were very upset, and that makes sense. So we try to be, again, very transparent on how things work, how to help things. One thing that I want to highlight as well, having one middleman is also a good way to have everybody behave correctly in the room.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So let me tell you, let me explain you a bit about this. If we can tell a publisher, hey, we're pushing your data to that many subscribers, please tweet us, right? Do not block us or tell us when you want to do changes. Or if we have an actual relationship, we can do a good job for all of these subscribers, right? If each of these subscribers had to talk with the publisher independently and say, hey, I need this, or please do this and please do that, it probably wouldn't happen. So it's a very good way of leveling the play field where anybody gets the same data at the same time. Modulo a couple of nanoseconds, obviously, because we cannot send an infinite number of HTTP requests at any given time. Everybody gets the same data, and anybody gets the same normalization as well. So it makes everybody happier, and it makes it very easy to work with everybody else in the room.
Right. And speaking of that also, I mean, the APIs that you publish or that you use are pretty much standard APIs, right? I mean, I think you've got one for PubSubHub and then one for XMPP.
XMPP. Exactly. And we use ZEP60, which is the PubSub. And it's not an easy feat. I mean, I tell you, the ZEP60 spec is probably the worst spec out there online. And we try to stick with it as well. So we've added a couple things that are super feeder custom, but most of it is actually can be used by any library that supports ZEP60.
That's very cool, and it kind of leads back into the stuff that we were talking about before. And I have to ask the obligatory question, which I kind of alluded to before: why isn't Superfeeder itself open sourced at the moment? Do you plan to do that, or would that mess with your business model and so on?
We don't think it would mess with anything. It would not mess with the business model, or it would not be bad for Superfeeder itself. It would just be bad for the web in terms of if everybody starts to build their Superfeeder, then we still have the same problem. Rather than having X thousand subscribers, we're going to have X thousand middlemen, which is useless. I mean, the benefit of Superfeeder is actually to put resources in common, to put resources from many subscribers in common in a given place. So again, we expect, and there's actually a lot of services, not a lot of services, but there's a bunch of services that you could use that would do similar things. Google is one of them with their feed API. But the benefit of Superfeeder makes sense if it's actually something in the middle between many, many people.
Okay, so it sounds obvious, but the word hub really applies here in this sense, because you want it to be a hub for all of that content. That's very cool. Yeah, I was looking through some of the other stuff that you've been involved with. I know you've been quite involved with XMPP as well. We kind of talked about that already, but you wrote a framework in Ruby. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So when we started building Superfeeder, we needed to, as I said, to build XMPP stuff at the time, and we were still mostly relying on Ruby. We were looking at Ruby frameworks for XMPP, and the only one that was available was the infamous XMPP 4R, which uses Threads, and Threads and Ruby are, or used to be, because I'm not so sure about the last versions of Ruby, but in the 1.8 and 1.6, 1.86 and 1.87 times XMPP 4R and Threads in Ruby were a mess. So we started building our own evented model or framework called Skates, Ruby on Skates. And it's still working. I mean, it's still the core of our workers in Ruby. It supports, obviously, clients, but also components, which are a hybrid between an XMPP server and an XMPP client.
Excellent, and you're currently working on a server in Node.js. You were saying
exactly. So we're still in love with XMPP, and I mean it's a very very interesting protocol, and it changes. I mean, in our vision, it is very very different from HTTP, and HTTP is slowly moving toward not XMPP, but toward protocols that would be more like XMPP, and so we wrote a Node.js server. An XMPP server, and the most interesting thing about it is actually it can use WebSockets as the underlying protocol rather than using the TCP/IP stuff. So it makes basically it hopefully can make any browser become an XMPP client and make it very easy to deploy XMPP server on any node platform.
Now, a lot of people I've been talking to lately, developers and people involved in different projects, have mentioned the fact that they believe Node.js is the way to go because everybody already kind of has to do JavaScript for web front-end stuff. So do you find it useful to work in the same language on the front and the back end? Is that a good thing, do you think?
I think it's a convenient thing. In terms of is it a good thing, I mean, there's a lot of heat around the fact that Node is obviously an evented model, and there's always been this war online between evented versus threads for many, many years. I'm still not convinced either. I mean, both solutions have pros and cons. I guess there is no perfect solution here. Node is obviously all on the evented side, which brings some, I wouldn't say issues, but some question marks in terms of how you're going to scale these kind of services in the future. But at the same time, yeah, I have to agree. Using JS on both sides makes it a breeze for a lot of things.
Excellent. And I know that you're actually, in your background, you were a banker, a former banker and so on. So I'm curious to know, how does a banker go from, well, banking to, you know, programming technology and stuff like that? Is there a parallel there?
Yeah, so it's actually the other way around. I am an engineer. I got a computer science degree, a master of science from two universities, actually. So I was an engineer first. And when I was in engineering school here in France, I created my first company. And by the end of the year, I started putting AdSense money on my bank account. And one day, my dad was really upset and called me and said, "Hey, what is this couple $1,000s that appeared on your bank account? Are you dealing drugs or doing anything illegal? You're going to get into trouble." And it's like, "No, Dad, no, it's fine. It's Google. It's AdSense." And my dad had no idea what this was. He's like, "Fine. When you get your degree, you're out of computer school and you're going to go to business school. You're going to learn how you can do a business and you're going to learn that you cannot put a check on your bank account like this." So I went for a year and got a degree in finance and corporate strategy. And it was very interesting and I wanted to work in the US. And the only way for a French engineer, or not the only way, but one of the easiest way for a French engineer to start working in the US is to actually work for a French bank in the US. And that's actually what happened to me. I started working for BNP Paribas in San Francisco in their leveraged buyout office.
I don't want to get too far off the topic of open source software and so on. But so what exactly were you doing for the bank then? What does that kind of thing involve? And how did that lead into getting back into technology, or, you know, full time into technology?
So the secret that I never told my boss at the bank is, like, I didn't really like my job and I didn't really want to make a career in there. I just wanted to move back to the US, ideally to San Francisco, to be closer to geeks and find a way to start my own startup there. So what I did at the time was we worked in financing leveraged buyouts, which are these evil thing that consist of buying a company with a lot of debts and then pressing the company in terms of trying to increase the sales and cutting the cost as much as you want to pay as much as you can to pay back the debt. And I did this for 2 years in San Francisco. I finally got laid off. So there's some kind of justice there. The whole team got laid off, actually. And I started this. I found this as a perfect timing to create my startup, Superfeeder.
Oh, okay, cool. And I noticed that you won an award, didn't you? Ranked among, you can tell I'm reading this from the biography, but in the Business Week top European entrepreneurs below 25. Yeah. So you were named in that. Do you get like a prize for that? Do you get like a big statue or something?
I think I still have it. I have a ranking in Google search for my name, and the link is from Business Week in the five. In top five or top 10 links, which is good. I mean, when people look up my name and find Business Week there, it's like, man, this guy is someone.
That is very cool. So I suppose a more kind of general question, getting us back towards Superfeeder, which is the subject we're here to talk about. What kind of things do you see on the future roadmap and stuff coming up for Superfeeder? Have you got any big plans that you want to tell us about?
Sure. So we're actually working, as I was telling earlier, in pushing. So let me start back from the beginning. So in both ways. So PubSubPub is a service that pushes, as I said earlier, data from server to server. So it pushes from Tumblr server to Google Reader server, right? And then obviously the Google Reader user needs to fetch the data. So it needs to open the browser and get the data from the Google Reader server. So the next step for us is to be able to push data from server to client. So there's a lot of technologies to do this when there's a strong correlation between the client and the server. Obviously, when you use Twitter, you see this, or when you use Facebook, you see this, where you don't have to refresh the page and new data appears there. WebSocket is the way to do it. So we have a strong belief that very soon data is going to be pushed from servers straight to browsers without the user doing any action, and it's going to be ubiquitous. So any server or any website that you've used is going to be able to push your data. Hopefully, it's not going to be more emails. It's going to be more messages that appear in your browser, and you're going to be able to interact with that. So that's one of the things that we're working on, is trying to be able to push content straight to browsers.
That's really interesting. It's obviously the next. It seems like a logical next step here is to be able to do that. I think that'll be really interesting to see what products come out of that. Also, I saw there was something recently called Message Boy. Is that a new feature?
That's actually the product. So that's actually, the product that we're going to release hopefully soon, sooner than later, that is going to be able to push data from the servers, the services that you use the most online, to your browser.
Ah, okay, good. Well,
it seemed like secret, something so similar to what you were talking about. Don't say too loud.
Yeah. Well, it was on the blog, so it can't be too secret, right?
It's not too secret. I mean, if people are interested, go to messageboy.com, and we're going to be able to launch very soon. We use a lot of HTML5 technologies that are not quite baked, including WebSockets that are changing pretty much on every release of modern browsers, but also stuff like IndexedDB and a bunch of other very cool technologies that are very, very early stage. So that's why it's still very rough around the edges, but we have good hopes for the future.
Right. Well, and I want to say too that, it's kind of interesting. A lot of times web services, we don't talk about open source. So for example, a lot of times we talk about, pure open source projects, right? Like Apache. And we talk about open source a lot in those conversations. We haven't talked about it as much in this case, but I just think it's really good when web services like yours are built on open source, are using open source. And as we've talked today, it's obvious, you're contributing back in terms of XMPP and Node.js and things like that, contributing back open source code as well. So the Superfeeder is using the open source ecosystem, benefiting from that, and also contributing back, which I think is the key here.
Yeah, it's the goal. And a lot of, what I really love about open source is the fact that anybody can contribute and anybody is part of it, in terms of, even if I don't know the people doing Nginx or don't know the people doing Apache or anything, I can just fetch the code and play with it and do my thing and maybe even commit a few changes and push them back. The actual project owner can implement them or not. On the web, where we have this software as a service approach, it's not that easy to actually contribute stuff back. But the interesting way of doing it is to be a good citizen and make sure that you work with others as well, so that your data, the protocol that you use, is something compatible that somebody else can reuse and can work from there without your prior consent.
Right. And since we have a lot of developers that watch the show, listen to the show, et cetera, usually for open source projects, when we interview those project leaders and so forth, we ask, how can people get involved? How can they contribute to your project? Well, in this case, it's actually a web service. But are there things that you would ask for? I mean, this is your chance. Are you looking for any improvements in XMPP or any of the services or code that you use, open source code? Are you looking for anybody to contribute anything to those? Are there certain things that are real hotspots for you?
So we're trying to evolve the PubSub/PubHub spec to move a little bit forward. One of the key aspects of it is to start supporting arbitrary formats. So we've talked a lot about feeds, but a lot of APIs are actually not based on feeds, but using JSON and stuff like this. And we're trying to promote this. So if you guys have application that would need to push their content because you're being hammered too much by someone subscribing, just go out to the PubSub/PubHub group online, PubSub/PubHub in Google, and you will find it. And just submit your use cases and talk about how you do stuff and how PubSub/PubHub could improve your life if it supported arbitrary formats or if it did things that it doesn't do actually right now. Stuff like, obviously, authentication, et cetera, et cetera. Right. I mean, this is an open protocol again, so you cannot contribute code, but you can contribute protocol. You can contribute design, almost, like the way things should be.
Right. How should it look in the future?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Julian, we're almost out of time. I want to thank you for coming on today. It's obviously a very interesting project to me and Dan. I know a lot of people out there who are using it, obviously, are interested in it. And, you know, we're just glad that, again, you're using open source to build this great product for everyone to use. I think it's really fantastic. So thanks for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
And it's nice to see you in person as well. I was doing some research online, and it was nice to see that you are not a French Indian gangster visiting Hawaii. And if you don't know what I mean by that, you have to go look at the Google Plus photo.
Yes. So yeah, it was a very good friend of mine's engagement party, and we had a lot of fun, and I love this picture. But yeah, it's another side of me.
There, I've got it.
You got the banker, and you got this guy and me.
Yeah, so I've got the picture up now for folks that might be watching the live stream or watching the video later. Here's the. I hope you don't mind. I'm sharing your.
No, go ahead. It's fine.
Your Google Plus profile photo here.
I put it online, so I have to assume.
Yeah, luckily I was looking around. I saw some videos of you and stuff, so I just thought that was an interesting profile picture to put up there. So I didn't have any better way to describe it.
It's good enough.
Well, anyway, thanks again for coming on. We really appreciate it, and good luck with Superfeeder in the future.
Thank you very much for your time. Thanks for having me again.
All right, bye bye.
Bye.
All right, so Dan, very interesting project. It seems to be very straightforward as far as its approach, I think, and a lot of good open source code being used in the background to make this web service possible.
Yeah, I mean, you say it was straightforward. When he was talking about rings and all that stuff, I was starting to kind of, my head was kind of exploding, and I wondered how I was going to quite understand all that. But yeah, you're right. It does sound very interesting. And one of the really vital things for all publishers is, getting your updates out there in a timely fashion. And obviously real time is ideal. And if they can achieve that, then I think that's really good.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I always find it interesting, as things move more and more towards the web, I always think, well, is this going to mean that open source becomes less and less relevant? Similar with Android, for example. So you put a nice wrapper on it, this Android wrapper, for example, on top of the Linux kernel. Does that mean that the open source parts of it become less and less relevant? And I think that, this is the whole reason why, going back to the beginning of open source, why Free Software Foundation and things like that get started, right? Because you want people to contribute back to open source and have it be a valuable resource for everybody to use and not just hoard things. So I think it's great that they're contributing back to their open source roots, so to speak. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, in a networked world, it's very different now. As you say, there's a lot of stuff going on, over web services now. And the thing that we didn't really ask about, which is kind of the elephant in the room, would be something like the Affero GPL, which is designed to kind of deal with all that. But I think that would have been a whole other subject that we could have spent a long time on.
Right, exactly. Probably would have consumed most of the of the interview or a good deal of it. We would have lost some of the content there. So that's material for another show, though. Perhaps we can do a show about that. I think that would be really interesting. I know it's something that I'm interested in. So I think maybe if we could get somebody, some sort of expert or a server, somebody that's maybe leading the way there, maybe we could get somebody on to talk about that, because I think that would be really interesting for our audience. So speaking of things that are interesting, we ought to cover a few things that are upcoming on the show. And I'm just looking at the schedule here, and it looks like coming up next week, Randall will be back, I believe, to talk about Vadin or Vadin, depending on how you pronounce it, V-A-A-D-I-N, which is a Java framework for building modern web applications. Apparently it's supposed to be able to look really good, perform well and everything. So, that'll be interesting to see, how that plays out. I believe Randall will be back for that. In fact, Randall will be back for the next few weeks, I believe. Next up on October 26th, we'll have Massimo, DiPiero, talking about Web2Py, which is an open source, full stack Python web framework for scalable, secure and portable web applications. That should be interesting. Coming up on November 2nd, after that, we have Jeffrey Tallhammer talking about Perl Critic. I'm kind of interested in this one because Perl Critic is a Perl module that actually looks at your your Perl code and suggests ways to improve it. So if you're a developer out there using Perl or someone like me who hacks at Perl, not really very good at it, but I do use Perl on occasion, it would be actually really interesting to see how they do that, how they make that work. And, you know, 'cause it's kind of a subjective thing, right? For coders, you know, there's never a standard that says you must write code this way. There's always 100 different ways to do it. So I wonder how Perl Critic figures that out. Anyway, that sounds pretty interesting. And then on November 9th, we have a discussion with Antonio Scurri coming up talking about Lua. So most people know what Lua is, a powerful embeddable scripting language. So that's going to be coming up on November 9th. If you are in the Bay Area, I encourage everyone to go out and attend the East Bay Mini Maker Faire in Oakland. I will be there doing a podcast. And so if you're there, please come up and say hi to me. But most importantly, just attend the event. It should be really, really good. If you're a fan of the Big Maker Faire that happens in San Mateo and you just want to kind of see some more projects, cool projects that are going on, definitely attend that. And like I say, I'll be there. So please say hi. And also, you know, I should mention for people that are watching too, I've got some new growth going on here on the face. I know it looks horrible, but it's actually for Halloween. So I've got to grow something out for Halloween. It's going to be a little Tony Stark, for Halloween this year. So I've got to grow a goatee. So for those that are wondering, that's why I've got this awful looking thing growing on my face. At least that's what my wife tells me. Speaking of awful looking things, Dan, that's a bad one.
I was waiting for that.
Sorry about that.
Okay. Yeah, I was waiting for that. This is not for Halloween. I just happened to have a beard. I was just about to tell you how nice your beard looked as well, but I won't now.
No, I'm joking. Not anymore.
Yeah. So if you mentioned community events and so on, Maker Faire, great events. We have a lot of those in the UK, and there's an event this weekend called Barcamp Blackpool, which is part of the Barcamp movement, if you like. And it's going to be in Blackpool in the northwest of England. It's this Saturday. So if you want to come along, it's at the Blackpool Pleasure Beach, which is like a big theme park. So that's going to be fun. And it should be a lot of fun. So I'll be at that if you want to come along and say hello. And obviously, don't forget, you can always check Linux Outlaws and Rat Hole Radio and all these other things by going to danlynch.org and finding all the links there.
Right. And people can follow me at Google Plus is the best place. Just look me up by my name, which is required by Google. And or you can, of course, Facebook and Twitter. I'm just Aaron Newcomb there. How about you, Dan? Where can people, best place to follow you? danlynch.org?
Yeah. You can find me on Twitter, Identica, Google Plus. If you search for Dan Lynch on Google Plus, there's a lot of people called Dan Lynch on Google Plus. But you will see a picture of a guy with a strange looking beard and a red hat fedora on. That's me. And you can also find me on Twitter and other places as Method Dan. It's the two words Method and Dan stuck together.
All right. Awesome. Well, thanks so much for joining today, Dan. It's good to talk to you. We haven't talked for a while, so it's good to have you on again. You always ask great questions, so I'm glad to have you on whenever possible. So, okay, well, that'll wrap it up for this edition of Floss Weekly. Be sure to tune in this week, every week. Follow on Twitter at Floss Weekly or the Posterous blog, however you want to do that. Be sure to come back and join us because we'll be talking every week about interesting open source software and open source related projects. That'll wrap it up for this week. And thanks for listening and watching.